Well, hello, welcome to the unofficial Unrelated podcast where we talk about all things Unrelated and also really yummy French food. We're your hosts. My name's Alex. Just me. Actually, this is just a short little intro for a bit of a bonus episode. Eugene YK Chung of Penrose Studios was in my office in New York City last week. It was an absolute pleasure and delight. And we had a lot of fun building something, but with the combined forces of AgileLens, my company, and Penrose Studios, his company. If you guys remember the episode where we had Eugene on, he talked at length about all the incredible film work that Penrose Studios has done in the past, his history of Pixar, et cetera, et cetera. Definitely go check out that episode. But this was a nice opportunity for me to chat with him again. The roles were reversed. I've already been on his Compound Witness podcast. This was a new one. We had 42,000 live viewers. I don't know how that happened, but this was a very cool little discussion where he mostly interviewed me, but we also talked a lot about the strides we made in motion capture and VR and Apple Vision Pro development last week. So just introducing this talk that is mostly going to be led by Eugene. I hope you enjoy, and I'm waving my arms around like you can still see me if you're watching the YouTube channel, but hello and goodbye. Enjoy this talk and see you more soon.
Okay, looks like we are live. All right, Alex, welcome to our X Video Space. It's a pleasure to have you. I feel like
Thank you. We
got to know each other even better over the last week. And what a week it was. I mean, perhaps for our audience, we should start with an intro. It'd be great for the audience to hear a little bit more about you, and excited to dive in with some of the crossovers between AI, XR, and all the exciting stuff we've been up to for the last several days.
Yeah, excited to dive into this. Thanks so much for having me, Eugene. Mm-hmm. Hello, everyone. My name is Alex Coulomb. I run an XR creative studio in New York City called AgileLens Immersive Design. My background is as an architect and a lover of theater, and I was fortunate to be able to wed those passions by for a time, basically being an architect designing theaters. And that's what I was doing when the Oculus Rift DK1 came out, and immediately fell in love with that as a potential tool for pre-visualizing live shows, actual built spaces. And then over time, we got more and more involved with not just previs, but also creating environments, spectacles, experiences that could live solely on virtual devices and platforms. And I've been doing that for a long time now and enjoying every day of it.
Yeah, you know, I think, before we kind of dive into some of the stuff, I'd be curious, and, you know, we talked about this on a podcast we did together, but, you know, you kind of alluded a little bit about the sort of crossovers between theater and now XR. Obviously, I think as we were growing up, XR was not really even an industry or really on anyone's radar. But now, of course, it is an industry, but one that is maybe geared more towards, you know, other endeavors. I mean, on the consumer side, gaming, on the enterprise side, you know, you have things like, you know, people with oil rigs, doing HoloLenses and stuff. But theater, entertainment, stuff like that is not something that I think is on, you know, for example, a lot of people's radar. I mean, we've done a lot with at least the idea of crossover between movies and VR. And I actually think it's all kind of just one thing, right? Like the idea of what the next art form is. But how did you maybe give us a better sense of how you got to this path, right? How did you do this? How did you get to here?
Sure. I was always interested in emerging technology. I did a summer program at Cornell back in 2004, where I got to spend a lot of time with a CAVE, computer-aided visualization environment. Is that what that stands for? I've never actually thought about it. And that was amazing, just the ability to be able to walk around something that I had built in 3D. And it immediately struck me even then that it seemed ridiculous that, let's take architecture, for example, that the traditional way to represent architecture, this inherently spatial medium, was through flat drawings or renderings, which could never quite convey the sense of scale or movement that is so key to understanding those spaces. And so, when I was doing theater in high school and college, we were looking at ways to use also real-time video game engines and things like that. I had never considered myself a coder, but was learning just enough to be able to like make the creative things that we wanted to have. When I was in architecture school, we had specifically a theater program that we created within the architecture school where we would rehearse at crazy hours and use whatever, you know, 3D modeling and whatever skills we were learning as part of our shows. And that was a blast. So when I came to New York City in 2010 and worked for Raphael Vignoli and some Pencil Frasca architects, I was trying very hard to get them as excited about some of these other ways of conveying design intent but wasn't really able to get a lot of buy-in until working at Fisher Dax Associates Theater Planning and Design. When the DK1 Kickstarter was happening, I was fortunate that I had enough people around me saying, yes, Alex, go with God, learn how all this works. And I think we were all surprised, including me, how immediately it felt so relevant to be able to be like, okay, here's what it feels like to sit in row Q, seat 13. Okay, there's a bit of a column there, but mind you, at the DK1, you couldn't lean your head. It was more like Google Cardboard, but you could get such a good sense of what it felt like to be in different places in the theater and then cycle through different materials, different design options, different things on stage. And you just understood it so much better than you could trying to show someone who wasn't orthographically literate, you know, what that same information was on a plan drawing. So by the time the DK2 came out and you could actually like lean forward and say, oh, this obstructed view isn't nearly so bad if I, you know, move my head 2 inches to the left or the right. It just felt like a tool that we needed to use all the time. And what we also, I'd say, pushed on very early on was not just design visualization, but very actively designing from the inside out, like actually being in the space while you're changing the height of the ceiling or moving a wall or changing the shape of something to feel more ergonomically comfortable. And that was something that also felt incredible. So then you have things like Tilt Brush, which, of course, even in the early days, were allowing for people to sketch out very gestural design ideas without being too concerned with accuracy, but then being able to wed that with later phases in design where you do need to be more photorealistic and more precise, but really fine-tuning exactly what it feels like to be in those spaces. And so, of course, the theater side of that and trying out live workshops in VR and figuring out motion capture and all those elements was just a complete blast. And the ability to connect with people from the other side of the world, but to feel like you're making eye contact with them and really engaging with them as a performer, as an audience member, it's just the coolest sandbox in the world to be playing in.
Yeah, definitely. I think, so many things, as always, with like every comment, I feel like there's so many like fertile ground to kind of expand on what you're saying. So, I mean, a few things I want to kind of hint at, and then we'll try to drive into a few of these. But one thing, architecture, you know, I was speaking with, I'm lucky to be part of the Forum of Young Global Leaders, and there's a lot of really cool people there. I don't know how I snuck in, but there's a, you know, really famous architect and who's part of that program, and he's got a big interest in VR. And I remember talking to him about how, in many ways, like architecture is actually a huge part of, you know, spatial computing. I mean, it's literally spatial. If you think about like the spatial art forms, you know, like you have music, which is a temporal art form, among other things, right? You have visual art forms with videos, but, you know, spatial art forms are like sculpture and architecture. I'm just thinking through like the classic ones. I mean, the major ones we've had for a long time. And spatial computing, like, you know, the sense of space is so important. So everything, I think sculpture, I mean, you know, our head animator on Arden's Wake talks a lot about, gave a SIGGRAPH talk about how, and you know, about how to animate Arden's Wake, and like pointed to a bunch of sculptures, right? Like literally like ancient sculptures, like, well, this is our inspiration, right? So that's kind of on the human side, but of course the physical space is something very important. And it's actually something I remembered again, going into our, you know, basically our experiment, I'll call it, which in the best of ways. And yeah. It was really interesting to think about how I hadn't thought about the sense of space. So for example, Rose and I, the beginnings were, there was no animation, there was no story. It was literally just like, you know, a little planet in the sky, right? And there was like a little, I mean, it was a cute little thing that, you know, our future chief scientist came up with. And it was like, wow, this has a sense of place. So that sense of place was kind of the first thing that our first film, Rose and I, was kind of based on. Didn't even have a story. We didn't even know it was going to be about the little prince, but I was like, okay, cool. Like ball floating in air, right? Like in DK2, that looks really cool. So that was interesting. So architecture, definitely want to hit on a little bit on that, you know, time given. New York City, something you alluded to going there. I guess I never asked you the time, but 2010. So we were definitely concurrent, at least for some period of time. Because, you know, I've been on and off there for many number of years. First moved there in 2005, but also removed there. Oh, no. I think,
Oh, you are frozen.
Did I lose the... okay. I'm back.
There you go.
Yeah, thank goodness. All right. You know, that 4090 PC is just having such a hard time keeping up. I guess it had good old in here.
But I get the 5090.
Exactly.
It's obsolete.
It could have been something else. Yeah, it's probably, you know, the USB... Actually, the USB motherboard is probably a little overloaded. But yeah, New York... was reminded again about just, well, first off, how hot it is this time of year, but definitely I think it's extra hot and lacking certain amenities. Where I was staying, at least, was definitely, you know, part of a challenge. But New York is always like a challenge in ways you don't expect, but also extremely invigorating. And one thing that, you know, your team is so incredible, by the way, just getting to know them, being on the ground with them. Spiritually, you know, other than your unified love of New York theater, and particularly New York theater, which is definitely the best theater city in the United States, I think. I mean, my opinion handily beats San Francisco, but I feel like spiritually you guys share a lot of similarities with like a lot of Bay Area folks, at least that I know, like in the best of ways, right? You guys are tech forward, you know, and using cool tools. And speaking of tech, finally, speak on the last thing you said. One of the last things you said was, you're talking about like not being very technical on, or initially not being technical, but I mean, I'm curious about, this is the question I want to ask you. How have you grown that process to being more technical? Because I got to say, for the audience here, every time I would look at, you know, just like look up, how do you like do this with MetaHumans with Unreal Engine? How do you do this with Apple Vision Pro, you know, with Unreal Engine? How do you do this with Unreal Engine? Like literally Alex, i.e. at Ivers, is like everywhere. Like, and, you know, like it wasn't in any of my saved history or anything. It was just, he's just everywhere, right? When it comes to those topics. And I'm surprised to hear that you had no technical background, because now you're, you know, one of the sort of leading voices, I think, at those intersections, you know, those unique intersections. So I'm curious, both, like, did you have some kind of background in it going, you know, growing up, or did you just kind of learn on the fly? And what has compelled you to want to learn this thing? Because Unreal Engine is like, you know, I mean, as beautiful as it is, it's a tool that, you know, you often kind of bang your head into multiple times to try to get some kind of result. So I'd be curious to hear your insights and feedback on it.
Yeah. Well, thank you for saying that. It's an honor to be thought of in that way by you. And I think in the early days, even when I was younger, I thought of so many different things as tools that helped me get to a thing I'm trying to create. I remember trying to learn 3D modeling with Milkshake 3D. I remember trying to make a DVD of a play that I wrote and directed in high school, where I wanted to edit together a bunch of film footage and then author that with like Easter eggs in the DVD menus. And I was using Adobe Premiere and Adobe Encore. And like, I've always been the kind of learner who just wants to get their hands dirty with something rather than going through maybe a more traditional, like, first you need to learn this kind of coding and this and this and this. And I think I found the same thing with music as well. Like, I come from a very musical family. My father was in a rock band for 30 years. You, of course, also a very musical family. And I have a brother who can pick up any instrument and just play it and make it sound amazing. So I thought from a pretty young age, like, oh, I just didn't get that gene. I don't have that. And I thought that also because when I had, you know, band practice in elementary school, when we had guitar lessons and things like that, I had piano lessons that were mandatory. None of that clicked with me at all. It felt like a complete waste of time. And it was because of the fact that it felt too abstract. It didn't feel like I was learning or I was headed in a direction that got me excited. However, in high school, when I had a friend of mine who was like, hey, you want to learn guitar and start a band and like try to pick up some babes? I was like, okay, well, there's a goal. But then also the idea that we'd actually pick particular songs, and it's like, oh, I really like that song. We're going to learn something by The Offspring or whatever. And then specifically trying to learn how to play those particular songs. And then kind of little by little realizing like, oh, that wasn't so hard. Maybe I can learn something a little more complicated. Maybe I can do some finger picking. Oh, now I know power chords and I can play a billion songs with that. That translated very well into all the things that I've done with my career with VR and all that. And an example I might use is, I think kind of the power chords of coding would be the ability to toggle things on and off. If you've got a bunch of different things in your scene, whether it's animations or architecture or lights, and you just want to be able to go through, you can think about a theater show, for example, and like show control and cueing, like I want this on now and this off and this on and this off. Once I learned how to do that chunk of code in C# in Unity back in 2012, I felt like I was off to the races. I could do 90% of the things I wanted to do. And so using that as a foundation and then continuing to learn more things that then got me a little closer to what I was trying to create and trying to show. That's what I really needed, was I needed to have everything I was learning be very specific and towards a specific goal and never too abstract.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And so that was kind of like what helped, you know, guide you towards, you know, kind of building on this sort of, I mean, I guess this tool, I call it Unreal Engine. What keeps you going, I guess? Like what is the... Because there's like the, oh, I've learned to learn in a different way, right? And plenty of people who become good at things have figured that out, right? Like, oh, I didn't like math, but then I realized I like math because, you know, I was taught in this way, or history. So now that you've found the way to learn, that's step one. But step two, you got to keep going, right? Like these endeavors take years and there's a lot of, you know, efforts over years. So like what, there's got to be some vision or some goal. And I'm curious what those drivers are, right, for you.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, for me, as much as I love architecture, I'd say the primary driving passion is on that theater side and that live performance side, and driving towards something that will allow me and anyone else with access to these devices to feel like they are right up close and virtual with an incredibly talented live performer, be it music or theater or any kind of other kind of art. And that really grew out of the time in 2008 when I was studying abroad in London. And I was fortunate to have this professor there who had all the best connections in London. And he got us into the most amazing shows in the West End and the National Theater and off on, you know, some hole in the wall theaters that entire semester in 2008. And it occurred to me because up to that point, I had either been very close to watching my friends perform, which was fine, or I had seen very talented performers, but from like nosebleed seats, which isn't the same. And being there every week with, like, you know, Ralph Fiennes, for example, and being three rows back from the front row and seeing like the sweat and the blood and all of the subtle nuances of that performance happening right in front of me, it was better than anything I could have seen on film. It was visceral. There was a co-present thing going on with the whole audience there. And from that moment in 2008, I just found myself wondering if there was any way technology could start to democratize that incredibly rarefied experience of being in London, having access to these particular shows, these particular performers, being that close to them. You know, 0.0001% of the world will ever get to have an experience like that. So there has to be some kind of way that we can start to bring that to more people. And virtual reality, spatial computing, these tools seem like something that starts to give us access to that. One other thing I wanted to mention too, because you're asking about, you know, learning and all that. One of the reasons why I've made so many YouTube videos, it's not just selfless. It's not just to like spread the good word to everyone and educate everyone else. It's also for myself. It's because one of the best ways I can codify something and make sure that I really understand something is to teach it. And so that comes out in YouTube videos. It comes out through being an Unreal Engine authorized instructor. We're both about to be part of this fellowship starting tomorrow. And then, you know, in the weeks ahead, that educational drive is really nourishing for me and the people who I'm teaching, because of course when someone tells me they learned something from me, that's incredibly gratifying. So I want to continue to do that, and then inevitably in 2 years when I forget how to do a thing that I used to know, I can watch my old video and then I'm back to knowing it again.
And yeah, I can attest to that for sure. Live, we were definitely looking at Alex's old videos, you know, we're googling them just to figure out like how to do certain things, because a lot of this stuff is very, very hard. So yeah, perhaps it'd be great to maybe talk about you know, kind of lay the groundwork, you know, what is it we did? And, you know, what is it that I, you know, what are the things it's pointing towards? What were the, you know, highlights? What were the challenges? You know, I'll kind of tee it off by saying, you know, the idea was to take, you know, all these tools, you know, like whether they're AI tools, which we use some cutting edge tools, I'm happy to dive a bit into that, combine them with some leading edge like XR tools, but also like some old XR tools as well, things like SteamVR trackers that have been around for ages, right, with lighthouses. As well as new things like, you know, Quest Pro and Apple Vision Pro, which is great, like hand tracking, face tracking, et cetera, and combine them with, you know, Unreal Engine, MetaHumans, and things like that. So the idea was to kind of, well, it was an experiment, of course, and the idea was to lay the foundations of the beginnings of a, you know, short film, you know, kind of Penrose style XR short film, and develop tools to help make those short films, right? Using tools that haven't really, never really been brought together in this way. And of course, we can talk about the state of, you know, mocap, both live mocap and, you know, there's obviously traditional keyframe animation. It's funny that computer keyframe animation is traditional now instead of, you know, the whole drawing on pages, but that is, you know, where we are today. And that's what we have used in the past, pretty much exclusively, but excited for these new tools. And of course, there's existing mocap tools, but, you know, could we get something that, you know, kid in wherever could go and pick up and try to make cool stuff? And, you know, I think we're seeing glimmers of the beginnings of that, right? So yeah, maybe Alex, if you could, you know, tee us off on what it was and kind of what were the biggest lessons or the biggest challenges, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. For the benefit of our audience, one of the things that's so fun about working with Eugene is not only is he an incredibly brilliant creative mind, but also isn't afraid to be very technical and get in the weeds and try to make things work. I've definitely worked with very talented creative people before who are just a little too detached from the nitty gritty of like how you dive into these tools. And it feels a little bit like, oh, but why doesn't this just work? I thought this would work by now. And Eugene's like right there in the thick of it being like, oh yeah, I see why it's not working and let's see if we can solve it. So the idea, of course, was, you know, the beautiful Penrose Studios films that have been made in the past took a long time. You know, there's a lot of beautiful finessing and massaging that goes into everything from those characters, to the animation, to the story planning. But Eugene had a script and this had already made kind of a short film that worked, you know, in a flat format that we were using as a starting point and seeing, could we make, as Eugene said, kind of a Penrose style, you know, maybe dollhouse scale experience. Ideally, that could work both in Meta XR headsets standalone. The previous Penrose short films, of course, were desktop VR. So we needed to have it run standalone in MetaQuest, and then also in Apple Vision Pro if we could. And so one of the initial questions was, you know, can we use mocap in a way that is going to help capture the essence of Eugene's wonderful script in a way that either doesn't require too much cleanup or just at least gets us, you know, 90% of the way there, but still feels pretty good. So the idea was, you know, build all that out, see what we could do in terms of like hand tracking. We had some things playing with scale. We had ideas about developing, you know, UIs for pausing, playing, rewinding, et cetera. And then, you know, we had a preliminary schedule and then kind of got off to the races. And it was fun.
It was a lot of fun. I mean, what do you think were some of the biggest lessons? Like when you think of challenges, when you think of course, we'll get to the positives for sure. But, you know, and I think we kicked off with some of that. But what do you think in your head? Like, kind of what did you expect going into the week? And what do you feel like, you know, I mean, sure. What do you think like went well? And what do you think was like, oh, this, you know, these were the challenges. I mean, there are always going to be challenges when doing new stuff like this. But yeah. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. I can say that probably my greatest nemesis so far across all things tech remains mocap. And there's something misleading where every time I dive into a new project where I'm going to be using mocap, I think like, I've got this. I've been doing this for since 2018. You know, we started with Vive trackers playing in other social VR applications and doing full body tracking that way. And we've played with, you know, Xsense and Rococo, and we've done stuff with OptiTrack and Vicon and all these other systems that they come out. So I always am way too optimistic whenever we go into a new project requiring mocap about being like, it's going to be fine. I had sent Eugene kind of a preliminary schedule of how like I imagined the week going. And I think I said like day one, you know, pick the mocap solution, day two, do all the recording. And the reality was day one was, you know, play with some mocap solutions. Day two was like, oh, okay, but what if we like tried these other mocap solutions? Day three was more mocap solutions. And we got to the point where like we had a lot of really good research. I think we made some really excellent discoveries on hybridizing different mocap techniques and combining, you know, the upper body from Meta's Movement SDK, the lower body using Tundra trackers, using something like Megastake Man's Mega Mocap VR system. Mm-hmm. But it took us a long time to get there. So we came up on Friday morning and it was like, okay, Eugene, like put everything on. Let's like actually do some real mocap recordings now. And everything up to that point felt very much like R&D.
Yeah. And I think I definitely agree with you. And I think, you know, mocap just remains, or animation in general just remains difficult because it's both technical, but also, I mean, obviously very artistic, right? And the performance, whether it's a keyframe animator, an actor. I mean, keyframe animators are actors. They see themselves as actors, which they are, right? Mm-hmm. So they just don't happen to do it with their own bodies. They do it with, you know, through their art. It's challenging, you know, and I think, but it's amazing what we got done in a week, right? Like it's, I mean, you think about, you know, Rose and I, you know, which was so many years ago, but you know, that was done. I mean, that itself, the core work was 30 days, and you know, there was even a bigger team just, you know, focus on that. So, you know, just always startup energies. I mean, little things, always the little things, you know, for me, it's like, you know, lessons of, you know, always when you go and travel and do stuff, there's always unexpected things, but things like, you know, kind of lodging that, you know, was disrupted, for example, which is nothing to do with the, you know, the project, but, you know, obviously had a big effect on, you know, just my ability to do things. So, it's always like the little stuff like that. But when it comes to the project, I actually think, you know, you always come in very optimistic, but like you have to like realize again that, you know, these things take so much time. And like, I thought like, actually at the end of the day, we got something really interesting in a week. Right. And we'll share more. I mean, Alex has posted stuff already, but like getting the Mocopi system from Sony, combining it with the Quest, combining it with, you know, the Vive trackers or the Steam trackers, Megastake Man's Mega Mocap system. It was all very interesting. I think I'm pointed to some things. I guess the question I pose for you is, you know, and by the way, I think going to what you said about being technical and you know, among most of my colleagues, I would say in general, I'm like the least technical person, like in general, but I feel like I've had to learn, you know, it'd be nice to just kind of sit and just be like, you know, directing, writing and stuff like that. I mean, that's more what my background is. I did learn how to program at a young age. So I think that's helped a lot. Like I learned C++, my first language, when I was, in my early teens, right? So I was lucky to, so it was just like, you know, one of those old things, like learning how to ski when you're a kid. But like, I realized, you know, you can't always just do the things you want to do, right? Like, you know, this idea of what being a director is in traditional films, but I've noticed this with established directors as well. They like kind of want to be creative, but you can't really do that with VR. You have to really understand, you know, there are more technical directors out there, maybe like James Cameron and some others, but you got to really understand the technology in a very direct way to make good stuff, like just to be frank. And I learned that all the way back from the Rose and I, and have had to like osmose, you know, among like all these people who are just, again, much, much better than me, but I've managed to osmose some things about, you know, the engine, for example, just like, you know, sitting in those rooms and not actually doing anything. I barely committed a single line of code actually in most of my time doing any of my projects. But it's, you know, it's, I found it over years. I found that it's not only become, it's just become more necessary. I thought it would become less necessary because, you know, all the stuff would become standard and all that stuff, but I think it's just more necessary. And I think that's just is a testament to how early we are still when it comes to XR and XR experiences. But yeah, now that we've kind of like come back and seen what happened, like, what's your thought about like this solution? So take the solution and maybe give it like, you know, not just a month, but maybe like a year of dev, right? How do you think it would stack up to, you know, for example, we did play with Move AI. That was the original, you know, the original flat screen version of the film was using even actually Move One, not even Move Multicam. And I think Move One has some limitations, but, you know, provided something. But when you think of like Move Multicam, these AI solutions, when you think of like XSense, Rococo, these suits, and of course, Vicon and all these other things. And then we have these solutions that, you know, deving on, I guess in time, like, where do you think it stands? Where do you think that solution would stand in the kind of hierarchy of stuff? Right. Given that it were to become a butterfly instead of being in its cocoon as it is right now.
Yeah, sure. I think it's a really good question because some of it is dependent on the hardware itself. And then other parts of it are, yeah, how far can we take the software solution? Like, for example, I'm incredibly impressed with what is currently possible entirely using a Meta Quest Pro. You don't even need the controllers. Right. If you have a Meta Quest Pro, which you can get used for, you know, $500 now. They're not selling like hotcakes. They never were. I was going to say not anymore. Yeah. But with that, you can get eye tracking, face tracking, hand tracking, and with the Movement SDK, you can get some sense of really good IK inside-out body tracking. The only place where it really suffers right now is the lower body. Like, it makes some weird shuffly like movement with the feet. It's kind of guessing on that. It can do crouching pretty well, but everything down there is just total guesswork. So certainly, you know, we might see the Movement SDK develop to the point where it's using those cameras in a much more robust way to actually do better leg estimation. And who knows, we might get to a point where something like that is all you need. That being said, you know, you do want a more powerful chip in there. And it sounds like as things stand, the Quest Pro 2 isn't coming out till 2027. Yeah. So in lieu of that, you know, using some of these other solutions like Makopi, which, by the way, Eugene, we haven't told you that since you've left, we did more studies with Makopi in less interferency places, and it actually performed much cleaner, like no disconnects. June had it running for I think like 5 hours with like no problem at all. So I think that might be a solution that works really well, because as much as we like using an optical system that uses Vive trackers or Tundra trackers, that does require a lot more setup. And Eugene and I have talked a lot about wanting to come up with something or find a way to, as he already said, like give this to anyone who's in a dorm room anywhere in the world, and like they could do something that's pretty good, maybe not like professional grade, but like would turn some heads and you could actually create something of high quality there. So I would imagine that give us another year and we will have a very, very strong solution that requires Quest Pro and Makopi to do the legs and then kind of the rest of your body. And we'll be able to set you up in an environment where that looks absolutely fantastic. And to some people, they're going to think that you're in a, you know, $300,000 OptiTrack stage with everything being tracked.
Wow, you think it'll get that far? You think it could, yeah, this could rival OptiTrack? Interesting. I mean, I actually, in some future that isn't too far, I think it's clear that, you know, Meta Quest Pro, Apple Vision Pro, whatever, like Apple Vision Pro does such a good job with face tracking, lips, eyes, and then of course fingers. And fingers is a big problem. Like if you look at these XSense suits, like the Magnus gloves, Manus gloves, sorry, you know, they cost almost as much hardware wise as the actual XSense suits. And, you know, that's kind of interesting. I think I've lost video again, but hopefully we'll come back. Anyway, oh, there we are. So yeah, I think the interesting part about that is, you know, I think that without any trackers, we'll get to a point soon where, you know, you'll just be able to be a full body in these, you know, kind of standalone headsets. And I think it'll be both Quest and Apple that do this probably independently, and you'll be able to do that. And I don't know. I mean, trying to compete with Vicon, OptiTrack is amazing, but obviously a lot of challenges in the way. But the fact that you have that confidence, I think is pretty incredible. I'd love to see that if it's something that you guys have. And out of curiosity, when you put it away, is it means that like not in a room with a bunch of Steam lighthouses and all that? Was it just like in a separate room, like just very few computers, all that? Like what did it take to get that setup to work well?
Yeah, June started doing it from her apartment, and it seemed like even though there's Wi-Fi signals and cell phones and things like that, that was fine. I imagine that being in the Agile Lens office with like 10 of us all with cell phones and all these different Wi-Fi signals around, that probably had something to do with it. And yes, someone did mention, I forget who, that the lighthouses might actually interfere with Mokopi as well. So it could be any number of things. So it would be the kind of thing where it's like, it's not going to work in all scenarios, but I think we'll be able to come back at you or anyone else and say like, hey, if you buy, you know, Mokopi used for $400, a Quest Pro used for $500, for less than $1,000, set yourself up with this kind of room and these kinds of conditions, and you have kind of an inside out all-in-one mocap studio, and that'll be
pretty cool. Absolutely incredible. Yeah, I look forward to seeing that. I mean, I've got my Mokopis right here, so good to know that they are, you know, definitely. I mean, they're such an elegant solution for body tracking. I mean, it's easier to charge and all these other things, but it's just kind of a, you know, I mean, it's so accessible, I think, is the real kind of takeaway from that.
And there's silly things about it too that you wouldn't think would be a big deal, but like the fact that the Mokopi pucks or whatever we call them are labeled, and you actually see like, you know, the serial number or whatever for each of them, that's huge. Yeah. Like Eugene did a great job manually labeling all of his Tundra trackers, and you know, you have to do that. Otherwise, when you're dealing with Steam VR and all of the tracker management, it just becomes a huge pain in the neck.
I definitely agree. What other, I mean, this is fascinating. I love talking about this. What other things can we kind of share with the audience? Any other sort of takeaways, any thoughts?
Yeah. Well, this is ostensibly also an AI discussion. Yes. So I'm curious if you want to talk at all about what you were playing with for the vocal performance.
Yeah, so basically, I mean, it's I've created the flat screen version of it, and this is not traditional Twitter space. Otherwise, I would link the, but I think somewhere in my feed, I have this like MetaHuman video. You know, it was like 2 minutes made in, made with AI and MetaHumans basically in 1 week. And, you know, the voices were done with the voice generation. This is many months ago. So now we have, you know, Sora and these voice generation. I mean, OpenAI has some great voice generation stuff, but, you know, we're using 11 Labs. I was lucky to speak in Venice last year with the CEO, Matty, of 11 Labs. And I was a fan of his stuff already, but he just happened to be on the panel that I was at on AI and movies, which is everyone could care about, right? AI movies. But yeah, I was doing a vocal performance. So, you know, I was the actor for, you know, the two characters, Pytha, Mira Pytha, in the script. And that's what I did. I used MetaHuman Animator for the facial animations, and I used 11 Labs in that case for the voice generation. I actually wrote the script myself on a typewriter, so I had a 1950s Olivetti Latera typewriter that I love. It's the same one that Francis Ford Coppola actually wrote The Godfather with. And it's just kind of an incredible tool. So I actually was completely disconnected from the internet. The internet was not one of the tools I used, and I just wrote the script. So that's the only thing that didn't use technology in any kind. Well, I guess typewriter is definitely technology, but not one that's super modern. But yeah, we created these voices, and you know, actually it was a lot of brute force, but I'm curious, you know, I remember you had some hesitation on using the AI voices coming in, right? For, I think, a variety of reasons, many of which were good. Obviously you've heard, you know, I don't know if you heard the voices for the rest of the script, or because if you're able to hear them. And I can't say they're like the best actors in the world, but like, I'm curious what your thoughts were about, you know, the AI voices and the quote AI acting, out of curiosity, as somebody who, you know, wasn't involved in at least that part of it, as somebody who's an outsider, maybe who's a little more objective about looking at those performances. What are your thoughts about it and what it means or doesn't mean for the future of, you know, of performance of any kind?
Yeah. What's interesting is if I didn't know the voices were AI generated, I definitely would have thought they were coming from real performers. But I also would have questioned some of the choices of those performers and said, oh, is that really, you know, what they're going for? And so we've definitely had this discussion a lot. I mean, we've been playing a lot with in-world AI and Convey for a couple years now. And so for anyone who knows about, you know, this annual production we do of Christmas Carol, we had a very long discussion with our actor, Ari Tar, who always plays Scrooge and, you know, 50 other characters as part of that show, because we wanted to train 11 Labs on his voice and set up an AI version of Charles Dickens that would welcome people at the beginning of the show. So finding a way to do that never felt like it was taking away from what Ari's really good at, but was really just kind of taking stress off of him and allowing him to focus more on the actual performance, and the AI does more of these repetitive things. I think that's a really interesting debate, because certainly my hesitation with using an entirely AI generated vocal performance here was, you know, someone could make the case where we're taking a job away from an actor who otherwise could have given that performance. Now, there's a different case to be made if it's like, well, there was never going to be, you know, a particular budget for this, so there was never a reality where an actor was going to be hired. But that's the debates that I think are really healthy to be having. Like, when is this appropriate? You know, when is it okay for R&D? When is it okay for production? When there's a commercial side to it, you know, where do you go in that direction? So I don't have any answers, but I'm glad that we're having those discussions.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I think, you know, Hollywood's using AI more and more. And obviously there's, you know, SAG-AFTRA strikes and stuff, writer strikes over this stuff. But I have a sense AI is going to be used more and more. And actually, you know, I think XR, because of the, both the smaller market, but also that there's less attention on it, but also because there's less data to train on it. I mean, we barely even know what XR movies or theater is. AI certainly doesn't know because it doesn't have mass amounts of data to train on it. So there may come a time in the near future where movies like flatties, the flatties as we like to call them in XR, just become like standard, right? And XR actually becomes a place where you can get authentic experiences because it's harder for AI to make experiences in XR. Now, at some point, Meta and all the other people gathering lots of XR data are going to figure out how to do, you know, do those things. But may come a time where actually it's the place where you can find, you know, authenticity, right? In those environments in a way you can't find in the flatties. So, you know, maybe one, I don't want to call it prediction, but one thought, so to speak, to mull on.
Yeah. Yeah. And going back to, you know, why I'll pose this to you as well, but like, why are we so excited and engaged with this technology still? I think it comes down to this idea that it's still such a new medium. It's still something that hasn't really found its legs yet or found the language that's going to define what the next 100, 200 years of it look like. So if you could talk to someone and say, how would you like to go back to, you know, the early 1900s and be there while the cinematic language was developing before there'd been, you know, really established senses of like using montage. I think it was Eisenstein who did that, and like wide shots and close-ups and all these different ways of approaching that, what ultimately became a common cinematic language that today everyone is literate in. Like Eugene and I can sit down and watch, you know, Mad Max Fury Road, which has a billion cuts, but we're going to go on kind of the same emotional journey because we know how to read that like a language. Right now, something like VR is still like a little up in the air, and we're not sure yet the best way to have a certain kind of emotional journey. And I think, of course, Penrose Studios is already doing amazing things in that direction, taking the affordances of VR, but applying certain techniques that have been used in film and theater to make it really work well. But there's still a ton of experimentation going on from us and many other companies around the world that still makes it feel like there's an opportunity here to lay a foundation for all the creators to come after us. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, actually, it's based on the conversation of a lot of things that we've talked about. So the fact that the cinematic language doesn't exist, like the cinematic close-up, which was invented, I think you and I talked about this last week, was 15, 20 years after. You know, if the Lumiere brothers with the train coming into La Ciotat station was 1895, something like that, in 1896, whatever the date was. And then D. David Griffith inventing the cinematic close-up in 1915, 20 years later. I mean, it's just like, we had the tools to do that, right? That was just something we had the tools for. Like, you could have done that in 1896. We just took 20 years for someone to figure it out, right? You know what I mean? Like, to be like, instead of the proscenium arch, we're going to move the camera in and get a cinematic close-up. And you guys, we're using that even right now, right? We're using the technique that D.W. Griffith effectively created. I think all those, you know, pieces of language just don't exist yet. And it's actually exciting to be at the forefront. And if you study early cinema history, I think that's also where my conviction that like knowing the tech really, so you have to like, there's kind of three main kind of pillars here. There's the creative, obviously. I mean, that's, I think, obvious to make cool stuff. But you also have to, tech, right? Like, you know, you have to figure out what this camera, this moving picture is, right? Where, you know, like all the random stuff that went into that and the business models. In the early phases, the Nickelodeon was the business model. You put like a few coins in, looked in a set of proto VR glasses, and you saw like a black and white thing play for a few seconds. And that was like their business model. I'd say today, you know, XR still struggles with business models, especially as it relates to narrative. I mean, I think games, you kind of figured it out, you know, either, you know, you pay a bunch of money up front, you know, 50, 60 bucks up front for, you know, a beautiful experience like Half-Life Alyx, single player, or, you know, you get a bunch of people to be pixelated monkeys and run around and, you know, like you get in-app purchases to pay for the skins or whatever. Right. So, and I'm saying that with no disrespect of any kind. I mean, it's amazing what Gorilla Tag is doing for, I think, the XR community. You know, kids are just loving it and they're playing it. I can't play it, unfortunately. I have tried many times, but I get very VR sick even to this day. So I still have to create stuff that's, you know, friendly from a VR, what is it called? VR sickness perspective. So I would love to be a avid Gorilla Tag player. I can play Rec Room in teleport mode, even though all the little kids yell at me for being in teleport mode because they're like, oh, you're a cheater. I'm like, oh, I would love to play, you know, your mode, but I can't.
need to be comfortable.
And I was like, you're just disappearing and reappearing. And I'm like, yeah, I wish I could play the way you are, because I actually think that's a better, the superior game mode. Like, I think it's more strategically advantageous. But anyway, yeah, I think it's exciting, the times that we are in. And it's going to be a combination of sort of all these factors.
And isn't it bizarre to use Gorilla Tag as that example of how different that is from anything Mark Zuckerberg and anyone at Meta thought was going to be like the primary use case for VR? It's kids. You know, they were not targeting kids. It is using locomotion methods that very early on were like ruled out as like, no, that's going to make people sick. It's low poly. The graphics are like nothing special. So, you know, it just goes to show again, we're still very early days with this stuff. And I'm sure we're going to see another amazing app come out in the next, you know, year or two, maybe on Apple Vision Pro, that everyone says, oh my God, what an incredible use of the technology. And it'll be so different from what anyone was expecting.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I mean, what are your thoughts? You know, we have a little bit of time left, but, you know, to our kind of close to 20,000 live viewers right now, actually, which is pretty incredible. Yeah. So wow. We have a lot of people listening in. I apologize. 41,000. If my numbers are correct, you have 41,000 viewers, doubled Jeez. Since I last checked. I'm curious, and thank you, by the way, to the whole audience for joining in. This is very exciting, and it's great to be able to share experiences with AI and XR. But yeah, to the folks, what other predictions or thoughts would you make? I mean, for example, I'd say Apple Vision Pro, amazing product, hard to develop for, especially if you're doing it in Unreal Engine. I mean, you know, I think there are reasons why Epic and Apple aren't the best of bedfellows at the moment, but hopefully, you know, things will improve in the future. Unrelated to XR, I think, of course. And then, you know, things related to, you know, some of the mocap stuff that we did. We already talked a lot about that, but if there are any finishing thoughts, and then I want to shift gears a bit to some other topics. But yeah, what thoughts you have about now having done this, about the way people are going to view, right? Is Apple Vision Pro... is it pointing towards a future that's different from what Meta's pointing at promising? I'd be curious to get your thoughts.
Yeah, a few thoughts on that. So Meta, of course, I think is still very clearly targeted at a gamer market. I like the analogy many people have already made, that the Meta ecosystem feels a bit more like a game console, and then everything Apple's doing with spatial computing does feel more like an OS, like an operating system, something that actually has real productivity and enterprise potential. And that doesn't mean it doesn't work both ways. We've got, you know, games on Apple Vision Pro and some productivity use cases on MetaQuest. But I do like the fact that there are some very different propositions going on here. I'm very happy with the health of the ecosystem right now. I think we've suffered a little bit from Meta kind of being so far ahead of the pack on the consumer front for a few years, and they haven't had any real competition driving them to innovate or to fix basic UX problems. I remember how excited I was back when Google Daydream was evolving into the Lenovo Mirage Solo. And I think, yeah, Eugene, you saw at our office, we had this dev kit that Google had sent us with six DOF. You know, they look kind of like the PlayStation Move controllers. And that was before the Quest 1 had come out. And so when the Quest 1 was announced, it was like, oh, there's going to be this incredible race between Google and Facebook to like see who can have the best standalone headset. And then Google, like with so many things, was like, never mind. Now they're coming back, and hopefully, yeah, this huge fight between Meta and Apple and Lenovo and LG and all these different companies will hopefully just benefit us, the consumers and the developers, into creating more and more content. But who knows? You know, we might see a clear market leader relatively soon. That all being said, I spend so much time in my Apple Vision Pro not to play games. I think it's an incredible productivity tool. It's a home office I can take with me wherever I go. I'm still very new to the Mac ecosystem, and thanks to Eugene for helping me purchase my very first MacBook, which, you know, is serving me very, very well. So to be the ease of which I can mirror my screen and then just explore everything I need to do for work. I can have other windows pulled up. I can have a beautiful 3D movie playing to do that at home, at a coffee shop, on a plane. Absolutely amazing. And I'm so excited for where that's all headed. When I look at all this from a live performance perspective, I think one thing that's going to be really interesting is how all this technology starts to interact more with actual environments. Back in April, the Agile Lens team was part of Meta's Mixed Reality Hack, this wonderful event that Meta hosted in New York City at their offices, where we had 1 week to build something from scratch. And we created an app called Performer, like Performer, but with an MR at the end, for mixed reality. And what I found was so exciting about that and really kind of pointed toward the future for me was the way that it was responding to your environment. And I don't mean that just in the way of like, oh, look, there's a Pokemon walking around and it's kind of occluded by the desk. It was the way that you could transform your environment into a fully digital environment, but based on the things there. So we had kind of like a steampunk aesthetic going on there. And so we turned your walls, your desk, your table, your chairs into furniture and a style that matched what we were doing. And I don't even know if there's a name for that yet, where it's still entirely virtual reality, but there's scene understanding and it's actually making everything match with the world. I know the word like tangible UI and everything has been thrown around a little bit. So there's that level of digital twinning going on. That's something I'm really excited about because I want there to be a live show. Maybe we'll get to work on something like this relatively soon, perhaps, where you have an in-person audience in an actual venue and there's live performers going on right in front of you. Maybe it's kind of like a black box theater style thing, but they're getting mo-capped, probably markerlessly using a system like Capture, for example. And then for the virtual audience who can be joining from anywhere around the world, they get to experience an entirely synthetic digital version of what's happening on that stage with all the affordances of what you can do in VR, flying around and changing scale and, you know, crazy spectacle and all that. But then also they can play some role with the physical audience. Meanwhile, the physical audience can be perfectly enjoying watching what's happening directly in front of them, but they could also be using mixed reality, AR, spatial computing to see a lot of that digital content happening right in front of them. And I know we're running out of time, but I do just want to mention like Calvin and Hobbes, for example, is a great example of what that could be. You could have Calvin or an actor playing Calvin up there on stage with parents, and it just looks to a regular audience like that adult version of the Calvin and Hobbes world where it's just people and parents and nothing crazy. Hobbes is just a stuffed tiger, but through AR, through VR, it becomes this way to see into Calvin's world where everything is so fantastical. All the colors are more vivid. Everything around allows for this level of imagination that is really only possible with these budding mediums. So, you know, probably won't happen with Calvin Hobbes because Bill Watterson does not want anything to happen with that wonderful IP that just wants to live as a comic book. But something like that, where imagination can really come to life using these new tools while still, you know, having something that works in theater's rawest form, which is two actors looking at each other and pretending. I want to see that whole spectrum covered. And on top of all that, I want that all to be able to be recorded and captured digitally through mocap, visually through, you know, 360 and Apple spatial video and all these different formats. So there's a compelling way to live this again. You know, I think there's something to be said for the way like Fortnite has done live concerts and the fact that those aren't live performances, but they feel live because you're there with that whole audience experiencing this for the first time together. There's all these other ways that these formats can mix and match and all this mixed media can create really compelling, exciting new content. And we've all barely scratched the surface so far of what's possible.
I love the way you phrase that. You know, kind of before we shift gears, and by the way, I actually have some questions on what you just said or comments on what you just said, but for the audience, I can't, so if you see me looking away, by the way, I've been trying to manage the audience comment stream. So, so I'm like trying to like my best to like, maintain. I, if you have comments, I know there's a lot of comments that kind of go on the stream, but we can't see them actually all here because we're live. But if you at mention me or Alex, I'm sure we could try to, you know, see them so we can answer any of your comments. But thanks everybody, for joining. It's been exciting and we're getting towards the final stretch here, but, the vision you presented is pretty incredible. And actually today, you know, if you talk about live performances, I mean, the way to get a lot of performers in things like VR chat, which is sort of like the beginnings of, you know, a social metaverse. And, you know, I think the best of ways, I think it's underrated in a lot of ways, right? I mean, everyone just talks about, you know, furries and anime girls, but it's kind of showing you what, again, it's something that I think the CEOs of these big tech companies aren't like, this is what I want the metaverse to be, but maybe it's the metaverse we deserve, not the metaverse we asked for, but, you know, to misquote Batman. But, the thing about it is the way that we're talking about Mokopi plus Quest Pro, which does face and hands up to, you know, like here, it doesn't work like with your hands behind.
Right.
I mean, I guess maybe with Mokopi, you could kind of do that, but that's kind of like the best way you could get performances that aren't just based on dancing, right? Because right today with 11 point tracking, you know, with Steam Lighthouses, that's how people dance. And there's some pretty incredible live performances in VR chat, but there aren't many like, I mean, there's some acting stuff, but you really obviously need the kind of like the face for acting to kind of work out, you know, like it's kind of like a basic part of acting. I mean, it's not, I would say voice maybe is the basic part of acting, but outside of voice, which you have in like these social VR experiences, but yeah, there's no kind of no other way. And I think, you know, MetaHumans today, you know, even seeing the MetaHumans kind of small, it reminded me, you know, how uncanny valley it could be, especially if the animation is not perfect, but also like you don't have Lumen in VR, you know, in like standalone VR, you don't have Nanai working, certainly not at frame rate. You'd have none of this stuff. And I'm just like, can you imagine when all this stuff gets added and it looks much more realistic and you get, you know, more than the XR I guess, what are we on now? The XR2, the XR3, whatever's in the MetaQuest 3.
The Gen 2,
yeah. I think it's the 2, right? And then, obviously the M2 in the Apple Vision Pro, super powerful chip. Actually, the Apple Vision Pro, I think, possesses the most powerful chip by a long shot, right? So, I mean, a lot of stuff there, but Mac obviously has issues with Unreal just in general, right? Because that's a Mac. I mean, it's a really powerful Mac right there, right? You know, so...
Yeah. And people don't know that Unreal Engine actually works surprisingly well on an M2 MacBook. Even an M1, any of the Silicon MacBooks will actually work with Lumen and Nanite. And so that means the Vision Pro, in theory, can work with Lumen and Nanite. We just haven't connected all those dots yet. We need, if anyone is listening from ILM, like, please share some of your code for whatever you did to make What If work, because that's a really good use of Unreal Engine.
Yeah, let's hope somebody from ILM is tuning in, and it's possible that they are. So I guess, you know, that's really interesting that you mentioned that. And I thought about that, but maybe the best use case, I mean, even right now, is just like those live performances, that are of a different kind than what's been popular today, which has been more like really cool dance performances, right? You know, like you get some really high quality dancers, whether in hip hop or ballet or whatever, and they're just in VR doing like really incredible things, right? You see them do crazy twists and turns and all that. So it's really incredible. And now acting maybe the next frontier. Yeah, in these kind of waning minutes, of which we only have a few, like, I'd love to leave it off with closing thoughts, but also just like, what do you foresee for yourself, you personally, Alex, right? Like, we talked about Azure Lens and a lot, but you personally, like, what would you like to see in the future? You know, what's the ultimate vision, the ultimate goal you want to push towards? I've had some discussions about this in the past, but if you think about what all your work comes to, where do you think in decades you'd want to look back and say, this is what we achieved, right?
Yeah. In decades, I want us to be at a point where you don't need to be in New York City to see the best theater in America or the best art of any kind. I want us all to be able to have easy access to incredible art. And I want to broaden that to not just theater, but film and sculpture and everything else. And especially as someone who grew up in, a place in New Hampshire and Vermont where everyone looked the same. Like, it was, of course, amazing for me to go to Syracuse, which at least was a university, and go to New York, which is such an incredible melting pot. And I think art and travel, these are things that open up your mind and help you connect to people. And, we're not going to go into like a big political discourse, but like, I think we can all agree that we are an incredibly divided people today. And there's a lot of contributing factors to that. But when you can have your mind opened by a really powerful emotional story, a narrative, for example, I think there's nothing quite like that. And I should mention also, I was the kind of person who used to think something like theater was pretty silly. Like, it didn't seem to me like anything that anyone should be wasting time or money on. But that was until I saw some really incredibly powerful, world-shaking, cathartic performances that completely rocked my world and like changed my value system. So yes, looking 50, 100 years in the future, I would like to have a bit of a legacy that says, hey, remember Alex? He helped establish foundational systems and platforms and methods for making it so anyone in the world can perform, create, and for other people to receive that in a simple, frictionless way, whether they're in a VR headset or they're getting it through other mediums. You know, whenever we do a theater show already, we try to have like a YouTube live stream or like a flatty version of it that you can play as well. So just continuing to iterate on that, making it better, making it easier, making it cheaper. Teaching other people how to do it as well. You know, we've been really excited to collaborate with Eugene and other artists over the past couple of years to try to see how we can help them bring their visions to life in really compelling ways. And I hope at some point in the not too distant future, I can say, hey, we've taken all these things we've learned over the past few years, and here's a platform. Here's like a thing you can just open up and get off to the races with creating, performing, watching, experiencing. And I hope that's the direction I'm headed in.
I love that. Excellent parting thoughts. We have mere minutes left. Maybe closing remarks or any final last question or anything you want to pose to the audience.
Yeah, sure. I thank everyone for watching. I love chatting with Eugene and would do it even if we weren't being recorded right now. But I think this is a really incredible time to be alive. You know, there's actually Teflon Sega, who has an incredible, series on YouTube where he does all this mocap stuff in Unreal, and he does these things with aliens. He posted actually a very touching video that I wish I could link to right now, that it's in the style of this alien who's just, doing like a TikTok video. But I think it was so resonant because the basic message of what this alien was saying in a comedy video was, think about the fact that 100 years ago, let's say 150, none of those people that you see in like old videos, old movies, old photos, none of them are alive. The people now, all of us together, all of us watching, listening, sharing this content with each other right now, this is our crew. Everyone who's alive right now, this is a tiny, tiny slice of humanity. And there's such an opportunity for us to work together and create incredible things. And I want to foster that spirit as much as possible. I want to encourage people to be creative, to help each other, to foster kind of the rising tide raises all boats philosophy. And especially in the early days of a budding, fragile, exciting new medium, I think that's so important. You think about how many inventions over history could have been discovered sooner or had come to fruition a lot quicker if there had been more communication and more collaboration. And I think there's absolutely a reality where due to any number of factors, we could see, you know, the trough of disillusionment or just a dip in the capabilities and the reach of these technologies really take a dive. But if we go in the direction that we're going right now and we kind of keep working together, I think there's an incredible opportunity for a lot of people to make a lot of incredible work that hopefully, not to put it too lightly, changes the world. So I hope that's the direction we're all headed in. And I'm going to be pushing for that as much as I can. And anyone, by the way, who wants to reach out and talk more about this stuff, yes, I'm iBrews on Twitter and YouTube and other platforms like that. I have an Unreal Engine podcast with Jacob Feldman that we try to host as much as possible. So that's the unofficial Unreal Engine podcast. I have an Unreal Engine authorized training center in New York City. So whether you want to learn more about Unreal Engine in person or over Zoom, you can find that at alexcoulombpresents.com. Agile Lenses, of course, at agilelens.com. Keep an eye out on the Unreal Engine YouTube channel because there's a couple talks I gave over at Unreal Fest for Prague that will be on there soon. One is called I Wish I Learned This Sooner, and that is very much a beginner-friendly video of like, here's all the stuff I wish I learned at the beginning of getting started with Unreal. And then there's another talk that's like a very deep dive into metahumans, really intended for people who have already gotten their hands dirty with metahumans and want to push that all further. So I hope these are all resources that are helpful to the community at large. And I love finding out that someone made something really cool because I gave them some direction there. I'll give one quick shout out to one person I met in Prague who said that he was listening to the podcast and he learned some Unreal stuff from a video I'd made. And then I had reposted a job with Lego. And then he actually got hired by Lego to build in Unreal Engine, all because of like these little like domino effects of what I had helped him with. And that kind of stuff just warms my heart. So, you know, look at the resources out there too. I guess that's a bit of advice. There's so many resources out there, so many people like myself, like Eugene, who want everyone to succeed and are willing to help and reach out to us. Don't be afraid. Don't be shy and show your work. Don't be afraid of things breaking, failing, not looking good, not working. There's seeds of amazingness in every single thing you would try to do. And I think one of the best things architecture school taught me was just have a tough skin and not get too hung up on when something really is broken and looks bad. And it's going to get better. You learn from that and you build on it. And that's all I have to say.
I think it's pretty incredible. Final thoughts. So thanks for sharing that. And it's been just an incredible time talking. I think there is, to underscore what you said, I think there's no actually better time to be in XR. I'm actually glad that the hype has kind of fallen since, you know, several years ago. And, you know, now it's at least a lot of outside observers still down in the trough of disillusionment. But I think as you and I know, you know, there's so many exciting things. You have things that are changing the world of XR and the lives of many little kids that, you know, made with like one person, right? Using like Unity or Unreal or some of these tools that you become so proficient in. So thank you for those inspiring words. To the audience, thank you for joining us. We are happy to have Alex. Please feel free to follow him everywhere, all the places that he mentioned. Thank you for the comments of the audience. I'll definitely be reading those after. And I do these, at least I try to do these video shows every Thursday, 11 a.m. Pacific. So please do join for the next ones. We are excited to have many more guests who are as exciting, exciting to chat with. So Alex, thank you for the time. I look forward to the next ones. I look forward to future collaborations. I look forward to where this fruitful conversation proceeds. So thank you very much.
Good. Cheers to you, Eugene. Cheers to everyone else.